Welcome back to another edition of YCT Matters. This is Carol Platt-Liebau, the president of Yankee Institute. And today we are joined by Paul Bachman. And Paul is one of the authors of our new study, Re-Energize Connecticut, Toward Affordable Electricity for All. And Paul wrote this in conjunction with David G. Turk, Dr. Turk, the president of the Beacon Hill Institute, and also Yankee Institute's own policy director, David Fleming. But first, let me tell you a little bit more about Paul Bachman, who joins us today. Mr. Bachman is an adjunct scholar at the Beacon Hill Institute and previously was director of research at BHI, where he managed the Institute's research projects. And he developed and deployed the STAMP model. And maybe we can hear a little bit more about that. But he's authored research papers on state and national tax policy and state labor policy, and produced the state revenue forecasts on behalf of the Institute for the Massachusetts legislature. He holds a Master's of Science in International Economics from Suffolk University. And Paul, thank you for your work on our study, and welcome to YCT Matters.
Thank you for having me, Carol. It was my pleasure. It was a fun project to work on.
Well, I am delighted, and I am delighted that you found this project to be, as you term it, fun. And so we are delighted because, as you know, energy is obviously an increasingly important topic across the country and certainly in Connecticut. And as you were working on Re-Energize Connecticut, I'm sure you developed an opinion, but in your view, how do Connecticut's residential, commercial, and industrial electric rates stack up against the rest of the country and against other states in our region, Paul?
Well, it's not surprising, or it was somewhat surprising that Connecticut has some of the highest electricity rates in the country, you know, just behind California, which is known for having very high energy electricity prices due to a lot of their policies. And I think that some of it is policy driven in Connecticut. And that is also one thing you've seen as a result of these very high prices is you've seen the consumption of industrial electricity fall over the past couple decades as many industries just can't compete with such high electricity rates. So they end up either leaving Connecticut or shutting down.
Yeah. And it's such a shame. And it makes it difficult. It makes it difficult for our businesses to compete and create jobs and have a thriving economy here. You know, you helped us with this study 9 years ago in 2015 when I was new to Yankee Institute. How has Connecticut's renewable portfolio standard changed from the time that we published our Restoring Power study back in 2015?
Well, first of all, it's sort of back in 2015, the policy was to kind of top out in around the early 2020. And then what the Connecticut policymakers have done is they've extended it to another decade, and they've increased the requirements. So you
and
have
so when
a
you say
higher
top out, you mean for our sort of more general listeners, you mean top out the amount of power that had to be produced through the standards?
Correct. So initially it was a fairly modest amount, but now it's close at 50%, and that's really forcing the electricity producers in the state and in the New England to really kind of that pushes the envelope probably a little bit faster than the actual technology can bear and the grid can really bear. And once you get to that point, you really see kind of it's hard to keep the grid balanced when you have that much intermittent energy on the system.
For our sort of more general listener audience, explain what renewable energy credits are.
A renewable energy credit is it's sort of documentation, if you will, that the energy supplier has either produced or procured renewable energy. So if I'm a renewable energy producer, if I'm a solar producer and I produce 1 megawatt of power, I get a renewable energy credit, and I can either use that credit to satisfy the renewable portfolio standard, which is sort of an accounting measure, or I can sell it on a market. I can sell it to another producer that's not producing the required amount of renewable energy.
And so how does all of that fit into Connecticut's renewable portfolio standards?
Sure. So all of the renewable, all of the energy producers, no matter how much energy or what kind of energy they produce, electricity, they need to either acquire these renewable energy credits in order to prove that they're satisfying the renewable portfolio standard, excuse me. So if I'm a natural gas producer and I produce 100% natural gas, but I need to produce 20% of my energy from renewables, I need to buy those credits on the market. So those purchases increase my costs. It's an increased cost. And if I'm a producer of renewable energy and I can sell those credits to other producers, so there is a market for trading these credits. And that's where sort of the marginal cost of producing renewable energy enters into the market, because that's kind of responsible for the one of the increases in electricity prices due to the policy.
You know, it's always interesting to me when people hear that Connecticut's renewable portfolio standards, you know, regime mandate for 28% of renewable energy. Do you think that our legislators realize that only about 5% of Connecticut's electricity needs are met by in-state RPS eligible solar and wind energy?
I'm not sure that they're aware of, but that's just a nature kind of the system, the New England system of trading energy, where you have a grid that's interconnected with all the states. And so if I'm a producer in Connecticut, I can certainly buy credits from New York or Quebec, Canada, or Maine, or anywhere else, because they can be produced in other states. So most of the energy that's used to satisfy the renewable portfolio standard is actually produced in another state.
Yeah. So we're really just buying energy from Canada or New York or something else to right. satisfy all this?
Yeah. And the hope is that it would be marginally less expensive to, you know, to get to hydropower from Canada as opposed to producing our own renewable energy. So it's likely a little bit cheaper to do that than to build our own facilities. Your own facilities in Connecticut.
It sure does put paid to all the talk that we heard at the beginning of this about how it was going to create a lot of jobs in our state, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's probably, you know, not produced the jobs that, the you know, were touted when the legislation was signed. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, our studies show that the portfolio standard actually, through the increase in electricity prices, has actually reduced employment in a marginal sense. So yes. Almost 2,000 jobs will be, over the next 6 years, will probably be lost or not created due to the price increase. And you've seen that happen over the past couple of decades, where the prices have risen so much due to a number of different factors, and that has hurt your industrial base and the consumption of electricity by industry.
Yes, it makes our state overall less competitive in a number of ways. On the upside, it's probably been good for Canada, so who's complaining? There's no thought that this would probably happen, but if we ended up repealing our renewable portfolio standards, how would other states be impacted? You know, the ones that generate these renewable energy credits that we buy. I mean, this would have certain impacts, wouldn't it, if we adjusted our regime?
It may have a marginal impact, but other, remember, all most New England states have renewable portfolio standards, so they likely would sell them to the others, but it would probably cause the demand for those credits to drop a bit.
Yeah.
So, because you would have a whole state of Connecticut basically not necessarily needing those credits. However, you will also have, you do have the companies and other, you know, different companies that actually have their own sort of renewable mandates. So they kind of will probably step in and buy some of those.
Pick up
so
the
there
slack.
Would be a small impact to you.
Yeah. So here's something that I thought was really interesting. Why does Connecticut consider burning trash to generate Class 2 renewable energy credits to be environmentally friendly? I mean, in what world? I am far from an environmental expert. But it seems to boggle the mind that burning trash would be deemed environmentally friendly. Can you help us understand that?
I can't really understand how that fits into the environmental impact, but I think it was lobbied in to include because there's a significant existing facilities within the Connecticut, and they were afraid that those would shut down. I think that's probably a little bit of lobbying.
Okay. How many decades do you think it would take for Connecticut to have enough land available to meet 100% of its electricity needs in state through wind and solar? Like, what would that require, Paul?
It would require an enormous amount of land, and I don't know that you would be able to actually complete it with the land in Connecticut. Because remember, you sort of site when you're siting a renewable project, the first place you site is going to be have the best wind, the best sunlight, and so forth. And as you get down, putting more and more on, you're getting to land that's less and less.
Desirable for it, right?
Yeah, desirable for or produces will produce less wind. It has less wind, less sun, and so forth. So you sort of kind of move down that. The best land is used first, and then the sort of least desirable land, as you said.
Your marginal gains decrease rapidly, correct?
Right, exactly. So there in some states, you kind of put a map out and you say, well, okay, there's no more land. You're gonna have to put a wind, mill on the side of a mountain. Well, you can't really do that. It's physically, the engineering is really difficult. You can't put it on a cliff. So a lot of land is actually not available for renewable, at least in some states. I think Connecticut's a little bit lucky because you don't have jagged, mountains like, say, in the Rockies and so forth.
Sure. That's really interesting. And I mean, obviously, it would be almost prohibitively costly in order to do it. Aside from just the economic costs, what other risks does Connecticut assume in relying more and more on wind and solar power?
One of the big risks, and I kind of talked about a little bit earlier, is that the distribution system, the reliability of the system gets threatened when you kind of get near that 40, 40, 50% renewables. There's a couple different things going. First of all, when the wind dies down or the sun isn't shining, you've got to have backup. You've got to have either battery, which is very expensive, or natural gas peaker plants, or even other peaker plants, and they tend to run, when they run very, very infrequently, the costs tend to really skyrocket when those peaker plants hit the market. So there's the reliability, and is a real kind of concern with the renewables, and that's why you need the storage. And if you have backup storage, batteries are, 4 8 hours right now, tops is what you can do. So if you have, a cloudy, windless period of a few days, batteries are done.
Yeah,
And
right.
you can't, it really threatens the, you would could have brownouts or blackouts, and the stability of the grid is threatened. Now, Connecticut has a little bit of leeway because you're in the ISO New England market. And so you can import electricity from other areas, but if all of New England is under clouds and it's calm, then you've got a real issue.
Yeah.
And or if you have a very a spike, a very hot summer day or a very, very cold winter day, and you can see what has happened in Texas, where they've had significant problems, and had significant areas where it gets very cold and they can't, a lot of the electricity just isn't functioning properly.
How much more in, can you estimate how much more a typical Connecticut household would pay for electricity in 2024 because of the renewable portfolio standards?
The typical household is going to pay a bit more in 2024. Let me just grab my figures here.
Sure, because obviously, doing things in a less efficient way is going to run up costs.
Right. And by 2030, in 2030, the residential customer will have an additional $96 on their annual electric bill. And for the whole period between 2024 and 2030, it's going to be about $542.
Yeah.
So some folks, that means a lot to them, especially if you're a
Of
lower
course it
income
does.
household, that at the margin, that's a tough bite to to
Well,
hit.
especially with groceries and everything else going up, and as we know, the cost of energy gets added on to everything. I mean, if it costs more to refrigerate groceries, then that gets added on to your grocery bill, where people are already staggering under the weight of these kind of things. You had mentioned that really the industrial manufacturing businesses are the ones that are the most impacted when you have high electricity, or it costs a lot to get your energy. Is that pretty? I mean, that's pretty much the case, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah, they're the big consumers of electricity. So any marginal increase in the price really drives up their costs. And what we found is that by 2030, the average industrial customer pay almost $5,000 more a year for electricity. And when you're competing and you have thin profit margins, that's for especially your smaller sort of industrial company that can really be the difference between making it and not.
Yeah, it's amazing. And certainly, even if people decide, okay, it's my home, I'll stay here, I'll try and make it work, there's no reason anyone would decide to come to Connecticut and settle here and try and make that happen. What federal and regional policies? We've been talking up until now about the state, pretty much the state renewable portfolio standards and state policies, but there are federal and regional policies that also impact our electric rates, aren't there?
Sure, there is an unbelievable amount of federal and regional. You've got the regional greenhouse gas initiative, where you've basically got to pay to emit greenhouse gases. You've got a myriad of federal policies. Not only the policies they're trying to put the Clean Power Act in that's been going through the courts, which would increase, force producers to use renewable energy or pay significant prices. So that's going through the courts. You've got a number, and you've got a lot of subsidies going to the to renewable energy, through the Inflation Reduction Act and others. And it's just there's a lot of money out there, but it's despite the fact that they've got all this sort of incentives and policies, electricity prices are spiking. And I think the last CPI report, they're up 8% year over year, and that's with natural gas being very, very cheap right now in many areas of the country. In Texas, I was reading this morning that the natural gas spot price for natural gas was minus $1.79 per million BTUs. So we have negative prices in natural gas, but yet we have skyrocketing electricity prices around the country, and I think we've got. Policy is part of the contributor to those increase in prices.
It really is. And, we don't have a natural ga gas pipeline here to New England, and that's a problem. And, Paul, you look at the Federal Jones Act, and it restricts shipments of natural gas for heating and electricity between ports. And it seems like there are a couple of common sense things that we could, if we could get them done, it would help people a lot. Really, really interesting.
Absolutely.
As we wind up, can you tell me where did you find most of the data for the study? Was it hard to find, or was it relatively straightforward?
It was a relatively straightforward. Most of the data came from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. They have a lot of data and on energy consumption. Also used went to the used. There's the site where they trade the RECs. They have data there. And also the Connecticut's own Department of Environment and Energy. They had a lot of reports that I was able to obtain.
Well, I really appreciate it because it's a dense subject. It's not the kind of thing that is for everyone, but for those of you like Dr. Turk and like you, and with an assist from our own David Fleming, when you all get this and you are able to put it out there and explain it so all of us can understand it, it's something that is not always readily comprehensible, but it is incredibly important and it has an impact on just about everything else. In terms of our economy and certainly the way we live. So, Paul Bachman, adjunct scholar at Beacon Hill Institute and author of Yankee Institute's Re-energizing Connecticut Study, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Carol.
Well, absolutely. And we thank all of you for joining us, and we look forward to having you with us. This is Carol Platt-Liebau. We will have you with us again on the next edition of YCT Matters.
I'll show you around this place I call home.